Welcome to On the Edge with April Mahoney Brains. Here, this is the spot where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. Welcome home, brains. There's only one requirement to hang out on the edge, is that you open your big brain and close your small mind. Did you bring your thinking caps? It's time to put them on, because the conversation starts now. Welcome to On the Edge with April Mahoney Brains. How are you? You're back at the spot, your favorite podcast, the place where the conversations are pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. Today, we're going to Austin, Texas, to visit with Dr. Julie Seemers. Brains, one of the third largest contributors to death can be malpractice. I don't know if it's malpractice. Would I say malpractice? Would I say errors? How would I phrase that, Dr. Julie?
In the literature, it's called preventable medical errors. Preventable, and so that's a pretty, yes, that's a pretty broad topic, but it's kind of encompasses multiple things.
So we want to talk to her from her zone of genius. She is really working hard, extra hard, to add an extra layer of education and protection for nurses as well as patients in hospitals. Brains, it happens. I know my mother went in and she was getting something. If I hadn't been sitting right there bedside, no telling what would have happened, because she had an allergic reaction. She started welting up, and the nurse is only going to come in when you ring the buzzer, but if you swole up like a bumblebee, that's not going to happen. Cardiac arrest, infections, there's a lot of things that can happen. But also I want to talk to her about what we as patients can do to provide information to our doctors. Do we have an allergic reaction to certain foods or medications that need to be in there? Do we have our medical directive for mental as well as physical? Someone to take care of us. There's a lot of people that are living alone. Do you have someone that can speak on your behalf? Do you have your living will and trust in order? These are some of the things that need to, you know, line up. And you don't have time to think about when you're laid up. So let's welcome her to the show. How are you, Dr. Julie?
I'm doing wonderful. And thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, I'm all over the place with this because I know what it is to be a caregiver. I cared for my mother for 30 years. And, you know, certain things, she wasn't able to advocate for herself. Insurance. She didn't know. They changed her diabetic meter. She was at a loss because she's never done anything electronic like that. It was just the old-fashioned way. IVRs, all the technology that nurses are required to have. Dial back and tell us a little bit about your experience in healthcare, how you became a doctor, how this became your zone of genius.
Thank you for that. And let me just clarify, my doctorate is in nursing practice. Okay. So I've been a nurse for 45 years.
Wow. You don't look a day over 30. That's
a good, well, thank you.
Good care for yourself. Good care.
Yes, I started out at the bedside caring for patients on the oncology unit and spent years in ICU. I worked in the trauma center. I spent 10 years on the helicopters as a flight nurse. And then I entered education. So that's been my journey for the past 15 years, is teaching nursing students in the simulation labs and clinicals. And then my last position was the executive director, so running a very large nursing university in Southern California. Wow. So I've had quite the gamut of experience, yes.
So when did you really, well, again, all throughout your career, I know that you've seen a lot of things. But when did you really horn in on the fact that I'm going to take everything that I learned and pour it into younger nurses or existing nurses to help them better patient care as well as better their skills?
That's a really good question. So when I, in 2009, was researching for my master's thesis, I came across a fact that just really surprised me, even being a nurse at that point, up to 25 years, And it's a topic called failure to rescue. And it is in the nursing literature, but there's still many nurses and educators that aren't familiar. And it breaks down easily to failing to recognize the patient's signs of deterioration or becoming clinically unstable. And I thought to myself back then, why isn't this in the nursing textbooks? And here we are 15 years later. I did do my doctoral project on that topic as well, because I think it's so essential that we learn about it, that we become aware, and we make the tools to make safe healthcare safer.
Well, it was really scary. I think it was maybe a year ago, 2 years ago. It was the first time that I had seen a nurse being prosecuted for dereliction of duty, or I don't really exactly know what it was. She gave the wrong medication, but I had never seen a nurse prosecuted, and she was devastated. I was devastated for her. There's a lot of responsibility given to nurses. I think nurses supersede the doctor, because you have to put the injection in. You've got to look at the monitor. You're basically texting him, and then he comes in and oversees it and checks a box, and he's gone in 15, 20 minutes.
Correct. You are right. The nurse typically spends 12 hours at the bedside. Mm-hmm. So the responsibility is on their shoulders to notice the patient's maybe one of the earliest signs is either an increase in respiratory rate, or the next one is neurological changes. So even if they're minor seeming, the nurse is going to be the one that noticed, or the family. This is exactly why I wrote the book too, to help families know what to look for and communicate with the healthcare providers. But you're right, it's essential. And the doctors aren't going to pick it up because they don't spend the time there.
Right.
And I think one of the clues, the biggest clues, and maybe take-home points, is that bridge of communication that I hope we can inspire conversations.
Exactly, because nurses are, they know what they're doing. We have a responsibility, that's not our zone of genius, to ask questions, but also provide information. A lot of times there's huge gaping holes in the information that is provided to your healthcare provider to assist them. You know, they'll go in, the first thing they do is check the vitals. And I was in the doctor's office, and one of the lady goes, "Why do you bother to check my weight and check my blood pressure? That's a key indicator of what's going on inside the body. Wouldn't you agree?"
Absolutely. It sure is. They call them vital signs because they're vital.
Wow.
Yes.
Tell us some of the things that you've run across, some of the hazards, some of the bullets we might be able to dodge, you know, just with basic information.
I think your point of sharing communication, you know, we are really lopsided in the healthcare provider, whether it's the nurse or the doctor, they have the education, and most patients and their families don't. But I think that's a really big opportunity. And so if the patient's family asks questions such as, "What medication are you giving my mother?" "Oh, well, this is for her high blood pressure." "Well, were you aware she takes a blood pressure medication at home?" That dialogue back and forth can prevent mistakes. So I think it really is important to have that openness with your healthcare provider of sharing information back and forth.
It is, you know, but sometimes you get, not all, but you get some doctors that have an ego.
You're right.
You know, I've done this for 30 years. That doesn't mean that you haven't had mistakes.
Right.
I think it's imperative to ask a doctor. I had a root canal. I asked him, "How many times have you done this? And what has been some of your experiences?" Because that may not be my experience, but at least I have an idea. And I want to see their integrity level. Are they going to be open to say, "You know what, I'm not perfect. Medicine is not a perfect science. There is going to be trial and error." So what kind of communication should we expect from our physician?
It is a patient right, which means that includes the family as well. Back in 1978, Congress passed the Patient Bill of Rights. And one of those is to receive information that's understandable. So if your physician comes in the room and says to you, if you're, you know, the daughter, maybe it's your mom in the bed, like you mentioned, she had spent some time in healthcare. And the physician says, well, your mom has cardiomyopathy and we're going to check her ejection fraction with an echocardiogram and put her on a diuretic. That was Greek to you, right?
Absolutely.
And so they know what that means, but really it takes just a few extra minute or two to say, her heart is enlarged. We saw this on the echocardiogram. That's like an ultrasound of her heart. We're going to put her on a medication to help get rid of the extra fluid, which will decrease the workload on her heart. Wonderful. Thank you so much. That's what it takes is please tell me what you.
Right.
Yeah.
But we're so busy. Number one, we're nervous because our loved one or ourselves are sick. We just don't think, or sometimes people are not bold enough to question a doctor. That's not something
you're right.
You have to be your own advocate. What are some of the things that you would recommend to nurses to help them bedside and, you know, not get caught up in a kerfuffle?
You're right, what you mentioned, and there's a term for it. It's called authority gradient, meaning we don't want to question or ask someone that we put or view as the authority and we're lesser than, so to speak. So yes, this applies to families and nurses sometimes don't want to question a doctor, especially if they, you know, seem like they don't have the time and don't want to take the time. But what I suggest is there's a little trick with a couple of words that we want to use, and I call it crucial or critical conversations. And so it's CUS, C-U-S, the cuss words. So the C stands for I'm uncomfortable, or excuse me, I'm concerned. The U is I'm uncomfortable. Or, and the S is, this is a safety situation, or I'm scared. And so if you just remember those, then you start your conversation with the nurse or the doctor. I'm really concerned about my mother. Her blood pressure is way lower than she runs at home. And then the nurse may say, well, this is normal blood pressure. Yes, but it's not normal for my mother. Is that a concern? And it should be, for example. Or I'm really uncomfortable that my mother just seems really groggy. This is not like her. It's making me really uncomfortable. Or I am scared that this is not going to have a good outcome because things just don't feel right. And a lot of times that gut feeling, you know, you've had that, right?
Absolutely. Where
you can't put your finger on it, but something isn't right. Mm-hmm. And so what I suggest is using those words and then see what a response you get and escalate if you're still concerned and you don't feel like you got an answer from either the doctor or nurse or healthcare provider that feels good in your heart
right.
or your gut.
Tell us about the three P's.
Those I love because they relate to how we show up. And that the first one is be present. So we have to be present both physically. If we want to, you know, catch the doctor when they come in the room to do their rounds, or at shift change when the nurses are giving what they call handoff report or shift report to each other, you learn a lot at what the offgoing nurse will say to the oncoming nurse. And you can sometimes fill in the gaps or the blanks and say, yeah, and remember my dad fell or almost fell today. He was dizzy. So make sure you're careful. So being present, but also being present within ourselves, knowing that we're grounded in our hearts and wanting to give the best of ourselves to facilitate the relationship. So being present. And then the other one is be polite. And sometimes either the healthcare end or the family's end, there's a lot of emotion going on, as you said earlier, when there's illness and sickness. But if we can just maintain that a lightness when we communicate. And then the other one is be persistent, as I talked about just a few minutes ago. But if you just know or feel or that something isn't quite right, or you really need more information, be persistent. You can do it politely, but say, sir or ma'am, I really need to understand this. And I would really appreciate it if you'd stay here and explain it to me.
You know, and that being polite, my mother used to always say that. She'd say, baby, you're not never rude to people that serve your food or give you your medicine.
Yes.
You always be polite, but you know, you get a lot more with sugar than you do with vinegar.
Yeah.
And I really, again, like to be prepared, and I like to ask questions and not be accusatory. Right. Things happen. We are all human beings. Mistakes happen. So I like what you said about, you know, being polite. I had one of my nurse friends tell me her patient bit her.
Oh my goodness.
Right. And then the family came in and wailed on her with a bunch of not so polite curse words.
Mm.
Emotions and tension is running high. But the calmer that you are, it's going to make it a much more pleasant experience for the person there that can't speak
right.
for themselves, or you are the one in the bed.
Being yes.
present, being there in the moment, trying to have, if you're not available, another family member, or build a relationship with the nurse. That's kind of hard because, you know, my mother would go in and she'd be in the hospital, and then the next day that nurse is off for 3 days.
Right.
But what you try to do is you try to build some sort of rapport and let them know that you're going to be an advocate, that you're going to be there, and that you really care about this individual. That's
yes.
That's one of the biggest things that you can do. So I want to hear a little bit about the book. You created a great textbook. Let's see it.
Okay. I don't know how it'll show up on screen here. If it's backwards, we get it in front of the, where's the camera? There we go. There.
All right.
There.
Yep. Now pull it. Dr. Julie, you have written this great piece of, I would call it, medical literature. What do you want the takeaway to be for medical providers, doctors, nurses, and patients as well?
Thank you. I wrote the book because I really felt like the patients and their families needed a tool of really the most important things to know when you go to the hospital. And I've actually had nursing friends read it as well as my nursing students. And they said, wow, I learned some things myself. So I thought that was great. But it gives examples, unfortunately, of patient harm that are all true. Some of the patients died in these stories and some, you know, survived but had pretty devastating consequences. And it really is to, oh my goodness, make it relatable, meaning if your husband has a brain tumor and goes in for surgery, you would relate to the story in the book of the woman whose husband was in the same situation and they didn't get the diagnosis and assumed that the biopsy was benign. 6 months later, because they didn't hear anything, they assumed it was okay. 6 months later, he had another headache, another tumor, and this one was cancerous. Then they found the pathology report from the previous surgery. And so it's just a way to make memorable, oh yes, if I'm in this situation, I know, as you said earlier, being your own patient advocate is so important because then you can say, I need the results, please. I haven't seen them yet. And then somebody finds them and said, oh goodness, I don't know how this got misfiled or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
You're dealing with a lot of people that are coming in and out of the room and
right.
You know, different tests are being done. When you go to a physician and you ask for a second opinion, what's a good way to do that? So, you know, feelings aren't hurt, but you're trying to, you know, get a second opinion for maybe breast cancer. You don't want to admit to yourself you're in shock. How do we gradually do that? What's the
That's a really good question. Yes. I think the first physician that you choose as your primary provider should be one, or any physician that you choose to treat you as a patient should be one that you have a really open relationship with, meaning that you feel comfortable asking questions. So if you start with the premise of that relationship feels open to you and it's collaborative as healthcare should be, then that physician should have no problem of you saying, I appreciate your opinion. My body is so important to me and my health. I'm going to go ahead and consult another physician. They should say, good for you. I would do the same.
All right, that's good. After COVID, nursing took a big hit. I mean, it was awful sauce. These people dedicated their lives to take care of others, did not have the protective gear. So it's really fallen off. I don't see people as excited about the nursing position. And there's nursing, there's, don't just be pigeonhole brains. It's not just bedside. There's education, there's specialties. But what would you say to a young nurse that's out there now to encourage her to stay with it?
I would share from my own perspective that this has been the best profession ever. I got into nursing actually because when I was 16, my mother had always wanted to be a nurse. And she said, Julie, why don't you be a nurse? And I was like, okay, that sounds like a good idea. And it's been honestly the best decision I've ever made, because not only is it the caring profession, that you can actually make a difference in someone's life, not just with morphine, but with a touch of your hand. Mrs. Jones, how are you today? And really look at them, give them a smile. That is sometimes more healing than opioid drugs, right? So you have the ability to influence and really make a difference in a meaningful way. The other thing I love about the profession, as I told you, I've had experience in multiple areas of nursing, but all of them have been fantastic. I've learned something and I've been able to serve patients and work with different teams of healthcare providers in many different areas, which stimulates my brain that needs to be constantly learning. So yeah. I think it's a wonderful profession.
I think it's a wonderful profession. Nurses and teachers are my favorite people on the planet, honest to Bob, because you could have been a chef. You could have been a seamstress. There's so many other things, but you have decided to dedicate your life for the betterment of humankind.
Yes.
A lot of stresses in these areas too, a lot of suicide that I really didn't think was true. What do you say to that person that is just completely burned out?
It happens. It truly does, especially when we're giving of our heart. And to be compassionate in nursing and healthcare, it does require heart. You know, when I was on the helicopter, and the urgent situation is we had to get what we needed to do to save that patient's life and get them on the helicopter and fly them to the hospital, you have to go into a mode of not feeling at that moment, but just doing the robotics of what you need to do. The feeling comes later. Of like, oh my goodness, I can't believe we just flew this 16-year-old girl that's in critical condition that may not make it. And you see her parents at the bedside. And so, yeah, it takes its toll on you in that regard. So I think you've got to refill your own cup.
Absolutely.
Because if your cup is empty, you have nothing to give. And we call it crispy, you know, when some of the nurses or doctors are just feeling cranky and crispy. They need some downtime and some self-care. Hard to do sometimes.
And, you know, it's work-life balance no matter what you do.
Mm-hmm.
But I could really see it in that situation. What do you do to keep yourself balanced?
Exhale.
Breathe, absolutely.
Yes. I love to read books that aren't based on academia, that really fill my heart And I love to watch, you know, it seems silly, but I love America's Got Talent or Britain's Got Talent. When you see kind of the underdog and they open their mouth to sing and you're just like stunned. Or the performances that people do that you don't even think look possible. It just kind of relaxes me into that a state of appreciation in a different way.
For your programming, who is your target market? Who are you really looking to reach?
I absolutely want to reach as many patients, just people, because we will all be a patient or have a family member or loved one that's a patient someday. So everybody on the planet that can understand, yeah, this is important that I learn how to communicate or open my voice, open my mouth and speak, because my health or my loved one's health may depend on it. And just learning little things like asking about medications, like we talked about earlier. So that is really important to me, is empowering the patient to become their own advocate. And when you don't have the knowledge, it's a little bit harder. And so I'm putting out some ebooks, shorter books. I've got this book, just in providing information that's healthcare related, but digestible or understandable to the layperson. Like, what is a tube feeding? What position should the patient be in? You know, they should never lay flat. And why? And then also want to, I want to bring the education that may have been missed in nursing school into the hospitals to reinforce and re-educate, because honestly, it doesn't matter which school. I've been at five different universities in 15 years, and they're similar in their curriculum. They're like drinking from a fire hose for these poor students. So it doesn't matter if they're 18 years old or a second career and they're 38 years old. It's a lot of information, and there's no way to retain it all. So my goal is to bring my education courses that really talk about the need to know versus the nice to know that maybe they learned but won't use too much in their. I'll give you an example. In a health physical assessment course in nursing school, there's typically about 100 assessment skills that we teach. They only use maybe 20. So why do we teach all those other ones?
Absolutely. Useful information. And then also repetition. It be reminded. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, that's right. Or this is that. Because at a point, we become mechanical animals.
Yes.
That's another thing. You know, healthcare is advancing so much. I had a situation with a friend of mine that had surgery and it was done robotically. She had no idea. She went in with
And there's
she went in for one thing and came out with a nicked kidney. And the laws have changed. I understand that, you know, medical malpractice was over the top. Doctors did couldn't even get covered for if they made one mistake. But then also you look at before the Affordable Care Act, pre-existing conditions. Who in the world has not had a pre-existing condition and you've been on this planet at least 5 years? You've broke
Right.
a bone, you know, you've had an infection, you've had a cold, a flu, something. So all of those things need to be considered as well. But also, can you talk to us about having your ducks in a row as far as your medical directive? So many people, I was one of those people until I did my will and trust that just, you know, didn't do it. What is a medical directive?
So, in essence, what do you want done with your body and your health if you're incapable of making that decision yourself? So, that just means if you're in a coma or had a stroke or any of those, you know, devastating things that can happen to us and you can't make your decision, no, I don't want XYZ in caring for me if I'm not able to do that. That's why it's such a critical decision to have with your family members, or if you're single and alone, have a healthcare advocate help you and write it down. So you need to understand if you're in a coma or have a brain injury and can't make those decisions, they healthcare is obligated to do everything to keep you alive, which may be an extension of, if your brain is not there and it's just a body, the rest of the body, they still have to keep that body alive unless you've got those directives. I know me personally, if I can't think and I'm not autonomous and I'm just laying in a bed taking up space, that's not for me. I want a life of quality that I can leave, or I'm okay to pass on. I don't want to be kept alive on a machine.
Right. Well, you know, I had a situation with a family member. They said, do not resuscitate. She was so frail that if you put those things on her chest or did compressions, it would have crushed her chest. That just let me go on and be, you know, with the Lord. But you are the person that makes that decision in the medical directive. It's not like, okay, they're there, and the wife says, I'm going to pull the plug. Just to safeguard yourself, I would have those documents in order on file in my doctor's and one at my home or my safe or whatever that indicates what my choice is.
Correct. Yeah, and you're talking about definitely if we've got terminal illnesses, that's, you know, a conversation. How far do you want treatment to go? Like you said, I unfortunately have had to do as a nurse CPR on someone with a terminal illness because there wasn't the advanced directive in place. And you're right. It's like, it's just heartbreaking to do that because you know they wouldn't want that. So the two instances really are terminal illnesses or a sudden event like an injury, you know, a devastating injury or a stroke or something. So think about it. You know, it may be a tough conversation, but I can tell you if you don't tell your family what you want, they'll decide. And it may not be what you want.
Absolutely. It may not be what you want, or you don't know what you can afford.
Right.
It's very, very expensive to keep someone on life support for 6 months or a year and they're brain dead. It's about the quality. And I'm speaking for myself. I can't speak for you. But it's about me, the quality of life, not necessarily the quantity.
Right.
I don't want
I agree.
To be laid up like lunch meat.
No. No, thank you. I tell my students if they ever found me in a position in the hospital bed, they better shave my legs and put on my makeup.
That's funny. So let's ask you some fun questions about you, because I like to get to know you a little bit. What in the world would you take me to do if I came to visit you in Austin, Texas?
Oh, we would definitely have to go to some of the outdoor events. Music is so big here. I mean, Austin City Limits is only once a year, but they have live music just in the shopping malls and at restaurants. And I love music, so that's fun. And the food trucks here are really good. Authentic, if you like Mexican and barbecue, oh my goodness. So that would be fun. And there's a great river here, a big one.
I told you my experience with the river. I'll sit there and with a fishing pole. I'm going to learn to fish now. If you were an appliance in the kitchen, what appliance would you be, Dr. Julie?
Probably the blender.
A lot of
I've never been asked that question. Really? Oh, I just think, you know, what makes up, I think of my life as the tapestry. I think of my life as my friends, as a different thread in the color of the tapestry of my life. And I think about all of that together, my good experiences, my mistakes, my kudos and my accolades all come together in that blender to make me who I am today. I don't regret any of them. Yeah, would I do something different? But I didn't know then. So,
right.
Yeah.
I'll probably be the air fryer.
I love that. Why?
Nice, it's clean, it's crispy, it's trendy. I think I like that. I'd be the air fryer. You mentioned something very pivotal. What would you say to a 25-year-old Julie Seemers, if you could have that conversation with her now?
Learn as much as you can how to help other people because we don't get anywhere without making relationships and connections. It is about giving. And it's amazing when you give just with your heart, what comes back to you that you didn't even expect? To me, it expands the universe. And so back then, I think I was probably a little more focused on, okay, I've got to do this. Like I was the nursing, the house supervisor when I worked at a hospital in Florida. And I thought that was just cool because it looked good on my resume. But I learned a lot too. But I would say put the focus more on the contribution.
And I think that that's speaks to the woman that you are and your character, because you are still pouring into that river of knowledge. You haven't just stopped. Oh, okay. Well, I've done this, this, and this. I've, you know, got my flowers, my accolades. I'm at the top of my game. You are still caring about patients that you're not bedside there, but you're caring for them from a helicopter view, from a much larger perspective.
Yes.
Back to my questions. Vanilla, strawberry, or chocolate? What's your
Oh,
favorite?
Chocolate and dark. Milk chocolate's too sweet.
What are some of your guilty pleasures? What are some of the things that you just do outside of, reading a good book or doing that? Do you like to bowl? Can you play tennis?
I love to play tennis. I haven't in a few years. But yes, I definitely want to take that up again. And then I took salsa lessons a couple of years ago that I really want to start that again too, although I wasn't good. I did it for about 6 months and broke my toe and I didn't continue. It was difficult for me. And I don't like to do things I'm not good at. But it was fun. Yeah.
You were an animal. What animal would you be?
A jaguar.
Really?
Yeah.
Third cat that I've had. I'd be the party animal.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, it's sleek, it's smooth, it's efficient. Yeah.
That's good. Well, would you like to leave the nurses and the patients with a little bit more wisdom before we conclude as to how we can embody this and really make it like a habit? You know, just you pick up and you order food or you go and get your nails done. It becomes mechanical. How can we take some of these things and embed them in us so that we're better patients or we're better providers?
You know, I think one of the things that my mom taught me when I was young, the golden rule, is do unto others. And I think healthcare really needs that bonding of treating and seeing each other, whether we're patients or peers or coworkers or whatever, as another human being. When they're cranky, we don't know what just happened to them this morning. We don't know what they're going through. And it's how can we really be connected with each other? And I think that is going to be a huge bridge in healthcare. If the ego physician could see your mother in that bed as his mother, or we as patients' families can, I know that doctor probably just, you know, had a really rough night. He was up at 3 in the morning answering calls because the patients in ICU weren't doing so great. It's just really that consideration for each other. I think we can really create a much better environment where we can talk about patient safety. We can talk about answering questions and having communication. You know, we're here as human beings on the planet, and we all are so similar on the inside of who we are. And it's just remembering that, I think that's going to contribute to the healthcare reform that really needs to happen.
And I believe you wholeheartedly. But another thing I want to add is teamwork makes the dream work. My mother was in the emergency room, and the camaraderie, shout out to Kaiser, the camaraderie of that team was amazing. Can I check on your patient for you? Oh, you look a little tired. Do you need me to Contact the doctor. Do you need me to check the vitals? Would you like a cup of coffee? When I observed that, that let me know that my mother was in the best of care.
Yes.
They did not just care for her, they cared for each other's well-being. And that offset possible, maybe someone could catch an error that the other one didn't. Maybe this person is distracted. Maybe, again, she needed to have some Benadryl because she had an allergic reaction. Or maybe they just needed to get off their feet because they had been on them for 12 or 14 hours. So
You're right.
healthcare providers work as a team, love on one another like you love on those patients, because us as family members or the person that's in the bed are looking to you. You have our life in the palms of your hand.
Exactly.
And so I encourage that. And again, I absolutely love that. It made me feel so good. So, Dr. Severs, could you please tell us how to get in contact with you, how to get a copy of the book, Brains? We are going to send this out to as many people I know, and I know a lot of people, because I want them to have this information. Don't overthink it. You don't have to overthink it if you have the information or you have a resource. So please
Yes,
tell
that's
the doctor
true.
in contact with you.
My mission is to help as many people as I can and to save lives and to make the healthcare experience better. So whether it be whatever tools you can find, happy to share that with you. My website is Dr. Julie Seemers. It's DR and then Julie SIEMERS. My book's on Amazon. I'm also on TikTok and Instagram and Facebook as Dr. Julie Seemers again, where I share tips and tricks, how you can just things you can learn. I'll give you a real quick example. I shared on a TikTok the other day about the hospital safety grade that hospitals do. You can find it as public information, and it will tell you whether your hospital is rated an A, B, C, D, or F, just like in high school or college. So if your hospital is an A, oh my gosh, awesome. They're doing most everything right. And a D or an F, they've got a lot of safety concerns or issues they need to fix. And again, it's just about being aware and what those things are to be aware of, like healthcare acquired infections, et cetera. But yeah, I love to share things that I learned that can help people, or things that I know that can help people.
Well, thank you so much for everything that you do. If you haven't gotten your flowers today, I'm giving them to you because it's not in vain. We do appreciate
Thank
you.
you.
We do love on you because you've dedicated your life to love on us. Brains, go in, get your medical directive. I'm a strong proponent on that. Get a copy of Julie's book. Read it, especially if you're a caregiver. You can't have enough information. The questions to ask, how to ask them, how to be respectful, how to be courteous, how to be polite, and just take it down. If you take the temperature down a little bit, it can make all the difference. It can save somebody's life. So I'm going to put all the information at the back of the interview. Again, Dr. Julie, thank you from the bottom of my socks because my heart. Just not doing
Thank you.
it.
All
Okay. All right, Brace. Look forward to it. Thank you.
right.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.